Elsa's gate. Something caught her eye in the brush along the gully on the right-hand side of the road, just inside the gate. Something shiny, throwing light back at the hard, hot cauldron of the evening sun. She hit the command key, let the gate swing back, and walked up the road to investigate. It was a shopping cart, flung on its side in the ditch and all but buried in the vegetation. The red plastic flap on the baby seat bore the name of a local supermarket, Vons. But the nearest Vons was miles from here. For that matter, there wasn't a store of any kind within miles. Kyra bent to examine the thing, her skirt pulled tight against her haunches, heels sinking into the friable dirt as if it would give a clue as to how it had gotten here. But there was no clue. The cart seemed new, bright in its coat of coruscating metal, barely used. She went back to the car, which she'd left running, to get a pen and her memo book so she could jot down the store's number and have someone come out and pick the thing up. After dragging it out of the ditch and wheeling it beyond the gate so they could get to it, she slid back into the car and wound her way up the road to the house, puzzled still and suspicious, her eyes fastening on every detail. The house rose up before her, its windows solid with light, commanding the hilltop like a fortress looking out on the coast of Brittany instead of the deep blue pit of the Pacific. She pulled up in front of the big wooden doors of the garage and killed the engine. For a long moment, she just sat there, windows down, breathing in the air and listening. Then she got out of the car and walked round the house twice, checking each door and window at ground level. At the same time, she scanned the upper windows looking for signs of entry or vandalism, but nothing seemed out of the ordinary. Finally, with a glance over her shoulder, she went inside. The interior was cool and quiet, and it smelled faintly of almonds. That was a good smell for a house to have, a clean, patrician smell, and Kyra realized it must have come from the furniture polish the maid used. Or could it have been an air freshener? She stood for a moment by the alarm panel, which she'd shut down this morning so Claudia Insti from Red House could show the place. And now she punched in the code to see if any of the 23 zones had been tampered with. They hadn't. The place was secure. She made a quick tour of the rooms out of habit, all the while trying to imagine possible scenarios to explain away the shopping cart. The gardener had been using it and left it behind by mistake. Teenagers had stolen it as a prank and flung it from their car. Yeah, sure, that had to be it. And yet, how had it gotten inside the gate? Why would they go to the effort of lifting it to that height? Why would anyone? Unless, of course, they'd gone round the gate through the scrub and Valley Oaks. But that didn't answer the why part of the question. She'd locked up and was standing at the door of the car, the air alive with birds and insects, when it hit her. Transients used those carts. Bums, the homeless and displaced, crazies, Mexicans, winos. But no, that was a city problem, the sort of thing she'd expect to find out back of the 7-Eleven, in Canoga Park, Hollywood, downtown L.A. This was just too remote, wasn't it? She'd swung open the door of the car, and now she shut it again. If someone was camping here, squatting, living out in the bushes, Delaney had told her they were camping in the canyon, miles from anything. If they could camp there, why not here? Suddenly, the image of a village she'd seen on a tour of the Yucatan ruins came back to her in all its immediacy. Naked children, pigs, cook fires, wattle huts. She couldn't have that. Not here. Not on the DeRoss property. How could you explain something like that to a prospective buyer? But maybe she was jumping to conclusions. All she'd seen was a shopping cart, and a new one at that, empty and innocuous. Still, she thought, she'd better take a tour of the grounds just in case. And though she wanted to get home early, she left the car where it stood and struck off to the south, in heels and stockings, to trace the perimeter of the property. It was a mistake. The lawn gave out less than 100 feet from the back of the garage, and a 10-foot-tall hedge of red oleander camouflaged the fact that the property sloped down into the scrub from there. She ruined a good pair of stockings pushing through the oleanders and hadn't gone 5 steps beyond that before she twisted her ankle in a gopher hole and damn near snapped the heel off her shoe. She saw the fence line in the distance, chain link buried in scrub so thick it was almost invisible, a meandering border that roughly followed what must have been a dry stream bed and then plunged precipitously over the cliff the house commanded. Kyra leaned into a tree to remove her shoes, then turned to wade back through the oleanders to the lawn. That was when she noticed something moving at the base of the main lawn, sunk down out of sight of the front of the house, buff-colored. A deer, she thought. A coyote. But the movement didn't halt or hesitate in the way of an animal, and in the next instant she watched the head and shoulders of a man appear over the rim of the slope, followed by his torso, hips, and striding legs, and then a second man, close at his heels. They were Mexicans. She was sure of it, even at this distance, and the origin of the shopping cart suddenly became clear to her. She didn't think to be afraid. In her suit, the sweat beating her makeup, stockings torn and heels in her hand, she stalked across the lawn to confront them. When she came round the corner of the garage, they were no more than 30 feet away, arrested by the sight of the car. The taller one, he wore a baseball cap reversed on his head and had a bedroll thrust over one shoulder, had stopped short, hunched inside himself, and he'd turned to say something to the other. The second man spotted her first, and she could see him flinch in recognition and mouth a warning to his companion as she turned the corner and came toward them. "What do you think you're doing here?" she cried, her voice shrill with authority. "This is private property." The tall man turned his head to look at her then, and she stopped where she was. There was something in his look that warned her off. This was no confrontation over a dog in a restaurant parking lot. His eyes flashed at her, and she saw the hate and contempt in them, the potential for cruelty, the knowledge and certainty of it. He was chewing something. He turned his head to spit casually in the grass. She was 10 feet from them and 10 feet at least from the car. "I'm sorry," she said, and her voice quavered. She could hear it herself, gone lame and flat. "But you can't be here. You're trespassing." She saw the look the two exchanged, flickering, electric, a look of instant and absolute accord. The nearest house was a quarter mile down the ridge, out of sight, out of hearing. She was afraid suddenly, struck deep in the root of her with the primitive, intimate shock of it.
"You own this place, lady?"
the tall one said, fixing her with his steady, unblinking gaze. She looked at him, then at the other man. He was darker, shorter, with hair to his shoulders and a silky, pelt-like streak of hair on his chin. "Yes," she lied, addressing them both, trying to maintain eye contact, trying to sell them. "My husband and I do, and my brother." She gestured toward the house. "They're in there now, making drinks for dinner." The tall one looked dubiously toward the house. The great broad artifact of stone, lumber, and glass that cut across the horizon like a monument to the ruling tribe, and then said something in Spanish to his companion, a quick, sudden spurt of language. She wanted to break for the car, fling open the door, and hit the automatic locks before they could get to her. Then she could start it up with a roar and swing round in a vicious circle, jam the wheel, hit the accelerator.
"We are sorry too much," the tall one said,
and he ducked his head, false and obsequious at the same time, then came back to her with a smile. She saw false teeth, yellowed gums. His eyes bored right through her.
"Me and my friend? We don't know this place, you know. We hike, that's all. Just hike."
She had nothing to say to this, but she forced herself to stand firm, watching for sudden movement. The man turned his head, spat out something to his companion, and for the first time she noticed the strange, high, breathy quality of his voice.
"Sorry," he repeated, coming back to her eyes. "A mistake, that's all. No problem, huh?"
The blood pounded in her temples. She could hardly breathe. "No problem," she heard herself say.
"Okay,"
the man said, and his voice boomed out as he tugged at his bedroll and turned to leave, the decision made, the moment expended.
"Okay, no problem."
She watched them head back the way they came, and she'd begun, almost involuntarily, to drift toward the car when the tall one suddenly stopped short, as if he'd forgotten something, and turned back to level his smile on her.
"You have a nice day, huh?" he said. "You and your husband. And your brother, too."
2. Cándido had been lucky. Despite his face and his limp and the fact that it was half an hour after the labor exchange closed down for the day and everyone had gone home, he got work, good work, setting fence posts for $5 an hour and then later painting the inside of a house till past dark. The boss was a Mexican-American who could speak English like a gringo but still had command of his native tongue. Cándido had been sitting there in the dirt by the closed-down labor exchange, feeling hopeless and angry, feeling sorry for himself. His wife had got work, a 17-year-old village girl who didn't know the first thing about anything, and he hadn't, though he could do any job you asked him, from finished carpentry to machine work to roofing, when Al Lopez pulled into the lot. He had an Indian from Chiapas in the back of the truck, and the Indian called out to him,
¿Quieres trabajar?
And then Al Lopez had stuck his head out the window and said,
$5,
because the regular man, another Indian, had got sick on the job, too sick to work. It was nearly 1 o'clock by the time they got to the place, a big house in a development of big houses locked away behind a brand new set of gates. Candido knew what those gates were for and who they were meant to keep out, but that didn't bother him. He wasn't resentful. He wasn't envious. He didn't need $1 million. He wasn't born for that, and if he was, he would have won the lottery. No, all he needed was work, steady work, and this was a beginning. He mixed concrete, dug holes, hustled as best he could with the hollow metal posts and the plastic strips, all the while amazed at the houses that had sprouted up here, proud and substantial, big gringo houses, where before there'd been nothing. 6 years ago, the first time Candido had laid eyes on this canyon, there had been nothing here but hills of golden grass, humped like the back of some immemorial animal, and the dusty green canopies of the canyon oaks. He'd been working up in Idaho, in the potatoes, sending all his money home to Resurrección. And when the potatoes ran out, he made his way south to Los Angeles because his friend Hilario had a cousin in Canoga Park and there was plenty of work there. It was October, and he'd wanted to go home to his wife and his Aunt Lupe, who'd practically raised him after his mother died and his father remarried. And the timing was right, too, because most of the men in the village were just then leaving to work in the citrus, and he'd be cock of the walk till spring. But Hilario convinced him. You're already here, he'd argued, so why run the risk of another crossing? And besides, you make more in 2 months in Los Angeles than you did in the past 4 in Idaho, believe me. And Candido had asked, what kind of work? Gardening, Hilario told him. Gardening? He was dubious. You know, Hilario said, for the rich people with their big lawns and their flower beds and the trees full of fruit they never eat. And so they pooled their money with 4 other men and bought a rusted-out 1971 Buick Electra with a balky transmission and 4 bold-as-an-egg tires for $375 and started south in the middle of the season's first snowstorm. None of them except Candido had ever seen snow before, let alone experienced or even contemplated the peculiar problems of driving in it. With its bald tires on the slick surface, the Buick fishtailed all over the road while huge, howling semi-trailers roared past them like death, flapping its wings over the deepest pit. Candido had driven before, but not much, having learned on an old Peugeot in a citrus grove outside of Bakersfield on his first trip north. And he was elected to do the bulk of the driving, especially in an emergency like this one. For 16 hours he gripped the wheel with paralyzed hands, helpless to keep the car from skittering like a hockey puck every time he turned the wheel or hit the brakes. Finally, the snow gave out, but so did the transmission, and they'd only made it as far as Wagon Tire, Oregon, where 6 indocumentados, piling out of the smoking wreck of a rust-eaten 1971 Buick Electra, were something less than inconspicuous. They hadn't had the hood up 10 minutes with Hilario leaning into the engine compartment in a vain attempt to fathom what had gone wrong with the machine that had already drunk up half a case of transmission oil, when the state police cruiser nosed in behind them on the shoulder of the road. The effect was to send everybody scrambling up the bank and into the woods in full flight, except for Hilario, who was still bent over the motor the last time Candido laid eyes on him. The police officers, big, pale-shouldered men in sunglasses and wide-brimmed hats, shouted incomprehensible threats and fired off a warning shot, but Candido and 2 of the other men kept on running. Candido ran till his lungs were on fire, a mile at least, and then he collapsed in a gully outside of a farmhouse. His friends were nowhere in sight. He was terrified, and he was lost. It began to rain. He couldn't have been more at a loss if he'd been dropped down on another planet. He had money, nearly $400 sewed into the cuff of his trousers, and the first thing he thought of was the bus. But where was the bus? Where was the station, and how could he hope to find it? There was no one in the entire state of Oregon who spoke Spanish. And worse, he wasn't even sure in terms of geography where exactly Oregon was and what relation it bore to California, Baja, and the rest of Mexico. He crouched down in the ditch, looking wistfully across the field to the farmhouse as the day closed into night and the rain turned to sleet. He had a strip of jerky in his pocket to chew on, and as he tore into the leathery, flavorless meat with quivering jaws and aching teeth, he remembered a bit of advice his father had once given him. In times of extremity, his father said, When you're lost or hungry or in danger, ponte pared, make like a wall. That is, you present a solid, unbreachable surface. You show nothing, neither fear nor despair, and you protect the inner fortress of yourself from all comers. That night, cold, wet, hungry, and afraid, Candido followed his father's advice and made himself like a wall. It did no good. He froze just the same, and his stomach shrank regardless. At daybreak, he heard dogs barking somewhere off in the distance, and at 7 or so he saw the farmer's wife emerge from the back door of the house with 3 pale little children, climb into one of the 4 cars that stood beside the barn, and make her way down a long, winding drive toward the main road. The ground was covered with a pebbly gray snow, 1 inch deep. He watched the car. It was red, a Ford. Crawl through that arctic vista like the pointer on the bland white field of a game of chance at a village fiesta. A while later, he watched a girl of 20 or so emerge from the house, climb into one of the other cars, and wind her way down the drive to the distant road. Finally, and it was only minutes later, the farmer himself appeared, a guerrero in his 40s, preternaturally tall, with the loping, patient, overworked gait of farmers everywhere. He slammed the kitchen door with an audible crack, crossed the yard and vanished through the door to the barn. Candido was a wall, but the wall was crumbling. He wasn't used to the north, had seen snow only 2 before in his life, both times with the potatoes in Idaho, and he hated it. His jacket was thin. He was freezing to death. And so he became a moving wall, lurching up out of the ditch, crossing under a barbed wire fence and making his way in huaraches and wet socks across the field to the barn, where he stopped, his heart turning over in his chest, and knocked at the broad plane of painted wood that formed 1/2 of the door through which the farmer had disappeared. He was shivering, his arms wrapped round his shoulders. He didn't care whether they deported him or not, didn't care whether they put him in prison or stretched him on the rack, just so long as he got warm. And then the farmer was standing there, towering over him, a man of huge hocks and beefy arms with a head the size of a prize calabash and great sinewy thick-fingered hands, a man who could easily have earned his living touring Mexico as the thyroid giant in a traveling circus. The man, the giant, looked stunned, shocked, as surprised as this actually were another planet and Candido a strange new species of being. "Please," Candido said through jackhammering teeth. And realizing that he'd already used up the full range of his English, he merely repeated himself, "Please." The next thing he knew, he was wrapped in a blanket, sitting in a big, gleaming American kitchen, appliances humming, a steaming cup of coffee clutched in his hands. The farmer moved about the kitchen on feet the size of snowshoes. All the broad geometry of his back was in motion as he fussed over his appliances, 6 slices of toast in the shining silver toaster, eggs and a slab of ham in the little black oven that congealed the yolks and set the meat sizzling in 2 minutes flat. And then he was standing there, offering the plate and trying to work his face into a smile. Candido took the plate from the huge, calloused hands with a dip of his head and a murmur of, "Muchísimas gracias." And the big man lumbered across the kitchen to a white telephone hanging on the wall and began to dial. The eggs went cold in Candido's mouth. This was it. This was the end. The farmer was turning him in. Candido crouched over the plate and made like a wall. There are always surprises. Life may be inveterately grim and the surprises disproportionately unpleasant, but it would be hardly worth living if there were no exceptions, no sunny days, no acts of random kindness. The farmer motioned him to the phone, and on the other end of the line there was an angelic voice, the sweet, lilting, gently lisping voice of Graciela Herrera, a Chicana from a town 5 miles away, talking to him in the language of their ancestors. Graciela picked him up in her bright yellow Volkswagen and dropped him off at the bus station, where she translated for the ticket agent so he could purchase his ticket. Candido wanted to raise a shrine to her. He kissed her fingertips and gave her the only thing he had to give, the laminated picture card of the Virgen of Guadalupe he carried for luck. In Canoga Park, Candido was able to find Hilario's cousin with no problem. The town was like a Mexican village writ large, and he got work right away with an English-speaking boss who managed 6 gardening crews of 3 men each. The cousin's name was Arturo, and he showed Candido what to do. It was nothing. Pull the cord on the mower, walk behind the air blast of the blower, cultivate the flower beds, and trim the shrubs. while they both awaited news of Hilario. Weeks went by. Candido shared a place off Shoup and Woodland Hills with six other men, and the close quarters and the dirt and the foul smells reminded him of his first day in Los Angeles, in the filth of Echo Park. He sent money home and wired Resurrección that he'd be home by Christmas. News came finally that Hilario was back in Guerrero, deported from Oregon and stripped of everything he owned by the federal judicial police the minute he re-entered Mexico. Things were good for a while. Candido was making $160 a week, spending $200 a month on rent, another $100 on food, beer, the occasional movie, and sending the rest home. Arturo became a good friend. The work was like play compared to struggling through the mud of the potato fields like a human burro or picking lemons in 120-degree heat. He began to relax, began to feel at home. Wagon Tire, Oregon was a distant memory. And then the roof fell in. Someone tipped off La Migra, and they made a sweep of the entire area 6 o'clock in the morning, snatching people off the street from in front of the 7-Eleven and the bus stop. 100 men and women were lined up on the sidewalk, even a few children staring at their feet while the puke-green buses from the immigration pulled up to the curb to take them one way to Tijuana, the doors locked, the windows barred, all their poor possessions, the eternally rolling TVs, the mattresses on the floor, their clothes and cooking things, left behind in their apartments for the scavengers and the garbage men. 6 a.m. Candido was among the throng, dressed for work, $110 in his string bag under the sink in the apartment behind him, the darkness broken only by the ugly yellow light of the street lamps and the harsh, glowing eyes of the buses. It was cold. A woman was crying softly beside him. A man argued with one of the Spanish-speaking immigration agents, a hard, high, nagging whine. "My things," he said over and over. "What about my things?" Candido had just left his apartment to wait out front for Arturo to swing by for him in the boss's pickup when La Migra nailed him. And now he stood in line with all the hopeless others. 8 immigration agents, 2 of them female, worked their way down the line of Mexicans one by one, and the Mexicans, as if they were shackled together, joined at the elbow, rooted to the pavement, never thought to run or flex a muscle or even move. It was the Mexican way. Acquiesce. Accept. Things would change. Sure they would. But only if God willed it. Candido was listening to the woman cry softly beside him and thinking about that fatalism, that acquiescence, the inability of his people to act in the face of authority, right or wrong, good or bad, when a voice cried out in his head, "Run! Run now while the fat-faced overhead pendejo from the immigration is still 5 people up the line with his flashlight and his pen and his clipboard and the green-eyed bitch behind him. Run!" He broke for the line of pepper trees across the street, and seeing him run, 2 other men broke from the line and fled with him, the whole macho corps of the immigration crying out in unison and flowing toward them in a wave. "Stop!" they shouted. "You're under arrest!" Things like that, the words of English every Mexican knew. But Candido and the 2 men who had broken with him didn't stop. They went across the road and into the trees, struggling up the refuse-choked bank to the freeway fence, and then, with La Migra right behind them, they went up and over the fence and onto the shoulder of the freeway. The cars streamed by in a rush, even at this hour. 4 lanes in each direction, the torrent of headlights, 65 and 70 miles an hour. Suicide. Candido shot a glance at the 2 men beside him, both young and scared. And then he began to jog up the shoulder against the traffic, looking to make it to the next exit and disappear in the bushes, no thought but that. The 2 men, they were boys, really, teenagers, followed his lead, and the 3 of them ran half a mile or more, 2 hard-nosed men from the immigration flinging themselves up the shoulder behind them, the traffic raging, thundering in their ears. And when they came in sight of the exit, they saw that La Migra had anticipated them and stationed a green van on the shoulder ahead. The boys were frantic, their breathing as harsh as the ragged, roaring whine of the engines as the headlights picked them out and the first of the police sirens tore at the air. Was it worth dying for this? Half the people on those buses would be back in a day, back in 48 hours a week. It wasn't worth it. It wasn't. Candido would never forgive himself for what happened next. He was the one. He should have known. And they were only boys, scared and directionless. It wasn't worth it. But when the agents came panting up to them, their faces contorted and ugly with their shouts and threats, something uncoiled inside of him, and he sprang out into the traffic like a cornered rabbit leaping from a cliff to avoid the dogs. The boys followed him, both of them, and they gave up their lives. All he could remember was the shrieking of the brakes and the blare of the horns and then the sound of all the glass in the world shattering. Pulp. That's what those boys were. They were nothing forever. And they could have been back in 48 hours. The first boy went down like a piston, torn off his legs at the hip, down and gone, and the second made it nearly to Candido in the third lane over when he was flung into the air in one whole pounded piece. The fourth lane was free, and Candido was across it while the apocalypse of twisted metal and skating cars blasted the world around him till even the traffic across the divider was stopped dead in horror. He climbed the divider, walked to the far side on melting legs, vaulted the fence, and became one with the shadows. And after that? After that, the trauma drove him from yard to yard, from green strip to green strip, and finally up over the dry valley-side swell of Topanga Canyon and into the cleft of the creek bed. He bought food and 2 pints of brandy with the money in his pockets, and he lay by the trickling creek for 7 days, turning the horror over in his mind. He watched the trees move in the wind. He watched the ground squirrels, the birds, watched light shine through the thin, transparent wings of the butterflies, and he thought, "Why can't the world be like this?" Then he picked himself up and went home to Resurrección. That was the first time he'd seen the canyon, and now he was here again, feeling good, working, protecting America from all that was out there. His accident had been bad, nearly fatal, but si Dios quiere, he would be whole again, or nearly whole. And he understood that a man who had crossed 8 lanes of freeway was like the Lord who walked on the waters, and that no man could expect that kind of grace to descend on him more than once in a lifetime. And so he worked for Al Lopez, and painted till nearly 10 at night, and then Al Lopez dropped him off at the darkened labor exchange, $50 richer. America would have missed him, he knew that. And the stores were closed at this hour, everything shut down. At 7, Al Lopez had bought Pepsis and burritos in silver foil for him and the Indian, and so he didn't need to eat. But still he felt a flare of hunger after all those days of enforced fasting. As he limped down the dark road, flinching at the headlights of the cars, he wondered if America had kept the fire going under the stew. It was late, very late, by the time he bundled up his clothes and waded the pool to their camp. He was glad to see the fire, coals glowing red through the dark scrim of leaves, and he caught a keen, exciting whiff of the stew as he shrugged into his clothes and called out softly to America so as not to startle her. "America," he whispered. "It's me, Candido. I'm back." She didn't answer. And that was strange, because as he came round the black hump of the ruined car, he saw her there, crouched by the fire in her underthings, her back to him, the dress in her lap. She was sewing, that was it, working with needle and thread on the material she kept lifting to her face and then canting toward the unsteady light of the fire, the wings of her poor thin shoulder blades swelling and receding with the busy movement of her wrists and hands. The sight of her overwhelmed him with sadness and guilt. He had to give her more. He had to. He'd buy her a new dress tomorrow, he told himself, thinking of the thrift shop near the labor exchange. There were no bargains in that shop. He knew that without looking. It was for gringos, commuters, and property owners, and people on their way to the beach. But without transportation, what choice did he have? He fingered the bills in his pocket and promised himself he'd surprise her tomorrow. Then he came up and put a hand on her shoulder and said, "Hey, mi vida, I'm back." And he was going to tell her about the job and Al Lopez and the $50 in his pocket, but she jerked away from him as if he'd struck her and turned the face of a stranger to him. There was something in her eyes he hadn't seen there before, something worse, far worse than what he'd glimpsed the night before when she'd left the rich man in his car. "What is it?" he said. "What's the matter?" Her face went blank. Her eyes dropped away from his and her hands curled rigid in her lap till they were like the hands of a cripple. He knelt beside her then and talked in an urgent, apologetic whisper. "I made money, good money, and I'm going to buy you a dress, a new dress, first thing tomorrow, as soon as, once I'm done with work. And I know I'm going to get work. I know it every day. You won't have to wear that thing anymore or mend it either. Just give me a week or two. That's all I ask, and we'll be out of here. We'll have that apartment, and you'll have 10 dresses, 20, a whole closet full." But she wasn't responding. She just sat there, hanging her head, her face hidden behind the curtain of her hair. It was then that he noticed the welts at the base of her neck, where the hair parted to fall forward across her shoulders. 3 raised red welts that glared at him like angry eyes, unmistakable, irrefutable. "What happened?" he demanded. masking the damage with a trembling hand. "Was it that Rico? Did he try anything with you, the son of a bitch? I swear I'll kill him, I will!" Her voice was tiny, choked, the faintest intrusion on the sphere of the audible. "They took my money." And now he was rough, though he didn't mean to be. He jerked at her shoulders and forced her to look him in the face. "Who took your money? What are you talking about?" And then he knew it all, knew as certainly as if he'd been there. "Dos Vagos? It was the one with the hat, wasn't it? The half a gringo." She nodded. He forgot his hunger, forgot the pot on the coals, the night, the wood smoke, the soil beneath his knees, oblivious to everything but her face and her eyes. She began to cry. A soft, kittenish mewling that only infuriated him more. He clutched at her shoulders, shook her again. "Who else?"
"I don't know. An Indian."
"Where?" he shouted. "Where?"
"On the trail." On the trail. His heart froze around those three words. If they'd robbed her in the parking lot, on the road, at the labor exchange, it was one thing. But on the trail.
"What else? What else did they take? Quick, tell me. They didn't try to..."
"No," she said. "No."
"You're lying. Don't lie to me. Don't you dare lie to me."
She broke his grip and stared into the fire, rubbed her wrist across her eyes. "They took my money." Candida was ready to kill, ready to hack through every bush in the mountains till he found their camp and crushed their skulls while they lay sleeping. The image infested his brain, the tan dog's eyes, the stirring limbs, and the rock coming down again and again.
"Is that all?" he hissed, fighting against the knowledge. "Is that all they took?"
He gripped her arm again.
"Are you sure?"
"Yes," she whispered, turning to level her gaze on him. "I'm sure." It hurt, that's all she knew. Burned. Burned like acid in an open wound, like the corrosive at the fat man's house when it got down into the split skin at the quick of her nails. Every time she peed, it was like fire passing through her. She didn't know what it was, some lingering effect of what they'd done to her that night, her insides scored and dirty, rubbed raw like a skinned knee. Or was it just a new and unexpected phase of her pregnancy? Was this normal? Was this the way it was supposed to be in the beginning of the fifth month? Flaming pee? Her mother would know. Her aunts, her older sisters, the village midwives. If they were home, she could even have asked Senora Serrano, the neighbor lady who'd given birth to 16 children, the oldest grown up and with children of their own, the youngest in diapers still. But here? Here there was no one, and that frightened her. Frightened her now and for when her time came. America waited there in the hut behind the wrecked car for Candido day after day, bored and aching. He wouldn't let her go to the labor exchange, never again. Her breast tender, her stomach queasy, needing her mother, needing to ask the questions a daughter never asks, not till she's married. But then, she and Candido never were married, not officially, not in the church. In the eyes of the church, Candido was already married, forever married, to Resurrección. And America and Candido had gone off in the night, silent as thieves, and only a note left for her mother, not a word to her face. And even then, America was pregnant, though she didn't know it. She wanted to call her mother now, on the telephone, one of those outdoor phones with the little plastic bonnets lined up in a row by the Chinese store, and hear her voice and tell her she was all right and ask her why it burned so when she peed. Was that the way it was supposed to be? Did all women go through that? But then, even if she had the money, all lined up on the plastic shelf and all the silver denominations, she'd have to call the village pharmacy because her parents had no phone, and how was she to do that? She didn't know the number, didn't know how to dial Mexico, even. And so she waited there in her little nook in the woods like some princess in a fairy story, protected by a moat and the sharp, twisted talons of a wrecked car. Only this princess had been violated, and her pee burned, and she jumped at every sound. Candido had got her some old magazines in English. He'd found them in the trash at the supermarket, and six greasy dog-eared novelas, picture romances about El Norte and how poor village girls and boys made their fortunes and kissed each other passionately in the gleaming kitchens of their gleaming gringo houses. She read them over and over again, and she tried not to think of the man with the cap and the Indian and their filthy, writhing bodies and the stinking breath in her face, tried not to think of her nausea and lightheadedness, of her mother, of the future, tried not to think of anything. She explored the creek bed out of boredom. She bathed in the pool,
collected firewood, repaired her old dress and saved the new one, the one Candido had brought home one afternoon for when they had an apartment and she needed something nice to get work. A week passed, then another. It got hot. Her pee burned. And then gradually the pain faded and she began to forget what had happened to her here in the paradise of the north, began to forget for whole minutes at a time. It was during one of those forgetful periods, when she was lying on her back in the sand, staring up into the shifting patchwork of the leaves above her, so still and so empty she might have been comatose, that she became aware of the faintest stirring behind her. The day was high and hot, the birds silent, the distant traffic a drowsy hum. There was another sentient creature there with her in the hollow place at the base of the intermittent falls, another breathing, seeing, sensing thing. She wasn't alarmed. Though she couldn't see it, she could hear it, feel it, and it was no man, no snake, no thing that would do her harm. Very gradually, millimeter by millimeter, like a plant turning to the sun, she shifted her head in the sand until she could see behind her. At first she was disappointed, but she was patient, infinitely patient, rooted to the ground by the boredom of the days. Then she saw movement, and the thing materialized all at once, as in one of those trick-of-the-eye drawings where you can look and look forever and see nothing until you turn your head, the magic way. It was a coyote. Bristle fur, tanned the precise shade of the dried hill grasses, one paw lifted, ears high. It held there, sensing something amiss, and looked right through her with eyes of yellow glass. And she saw that it had dugs and whiskers and a black slotted nose, and that it was small, small as the dog she'd had as a girl, and still it didn't move. She looked at that coyote so long and so hard that she began to hallucinate, to imagine herself inside those eyes, looking out, to know that men were her enemies, men in uniform, men with their hats reversed, men with fat, bloated hands and fat, bloated necks, men with traps and guns and poison bait. And she saw the den full of pups and the hills shrunk to nothing under the hot, quick, quadrupedal gait. She never moved, never blinked. But finally, no matter how hard she stared, she realized the animal was no longer there. The fire snapped and fanned itself with a roar. Sparks and white flecks of ash shot straight up into the funnel of the ravine, trailing away into the night until the dark drank them up. The night was warm. The stars were cold. And Candido, feeding the fire with one hand while skewering a sausage with the other and cradling a gallon jug of Krabari Red between his thighs, was drunk. Not so drunk that he'd lost all caution. He'd observed the canyon from above on the trail, with the fire going strong, and reassured himself that not even the faintest glimmer escaped the deep, hidden nook where they'd made their camp. The smoke was visible, yes, but only in daylight, and in daylight he made sure the fire was out, or at least reduced to coals. But now it was dark, and who could detect a few threads of smoke against the dark curtain of the sky? Anyway, he was drunk. Drunk and feeding the fire for the thin cheer of it, for the child's game of watching the flames crawl up a stick, and for the good and practical purpose of cooking sausages. A whole package, 8 hot Italian sausages, not as good as chorizo, maybe, but good nonetheless. One after another, roasting them till they split, using a tortilla like a glove to squeeze them off the stick and feed them into his mouth, bite by sizzling bite. And the wine, of course. Lifting the jug, heavy at first but getting lighter now, the wine hot in his gut and leaking from the corners of his mouth, and then setting the jug down again between his legs in the sand. That was the process, the plan, the sum of his efforts. Stick, sausage, wine. America, grown modest in proportion to the way the baby was changing her shape, stood off in the shadows by the hut, trying on the clothes he'd brought her back from the Goodwill in Canoga Park. They'd been working up the street, repairing stucco on an apartment building that was changing hands, and Rigoberto, the Indian who worked for Al Lopez, told him about the store. It was cheap. And he found maternity clothes, big flower-print shorts with an expanding waistline, dresses like sacks, corduroy pants that could have fit a clown. He'd selected one shapeless dress with an elastic waistband, pink with green flowers all over it, and a pair of shorts. She'd asked for blue jeans, something durable to wear around the camp and save her 2 dresses, but there was no sense in buying her jeans that wouldn't fit for another 3 or 4 months, and so he'd settled on the shorts as a compromise. She could always take them in later. All that was fine, but he was drunk. Drunk for a purpose, for a reason. drunk because he was fed up with the whole Yankee gringo dog-eat-dog world where a poor man had to fight like a conquering hero just to keep from starving to death, drunk because after 3 weeks of on-again, off-again work and the promise of something better, Al Lopez had let him go. Rigoberto's brother, the one who'd been ill, was back from his sickbed and ready to work. A hernia, that's what he had. And he'd gone to the gringo doctors to sew it up, and that was all right because he had papers, la tarjeta verde, and he was legal. Candido was not. "Haven't I done good work?" he asked Al Lopez. "Haven't I run after everything you told me to do like a human burro? Haven't I busted my balls?" "Yeah, sure," Al Lopez had said, "but that's not the problem. You don't have papers, and Ignacio does. I could get in trouble, big trouble." And so Candido had bought the sausages and the wine and come home drunk with the dress and the shorts in a paper bag, and he was drunk now and getting drunker. In 3 weeks, he'd made nearly $300, minus some for the food and the first dress he'd bought America, the pretty one from the gringo store. That left him just over $250, which was half what he'd need for a car and a quarter what he'd need for a decent apartment, because they all, even the Mexican landlords, wanted first and last month's rent and a deposit, too. The money was buried in a plastic peanut butter jar under a rock behind the wrecked car, and he didn't know how he was going to be able to add to it. He'd only got work once when Al Lopez hadn't come for him. And that was just half a day at $3 an hour hauling rock for a wall some old lady was building around her property. It was the end of July. The dry weather would hold for 4 months more, and by then America would have had her baby, his son, and they would have to have a roof over their heads. The thought darkened his mood, and when America stepped into the firelight to show off the big shorts with her jaguar's smile, he snapped at her. "Those vagos," he said, and the tongue was so thick in his throat he might have swallowed a snake. "They took more than just your money, didn't they? Didn't they?" Her face went numb. "You go to hell," she said. "Borracho, I told you 1,000 times. And she turned away and hid herself in the hut. He didn't blame her. But he was drunk and angry, and he wanted to hurt her, wanted to hurt himself, twisting the knowledge round and round his brain like a rotten tooth rotated in its socket. How could he pretend not to know what had happened? How could he allow himself to be fooled? She hadn't let him touch her in 3 weeks, and why was that? The baby, she claimed. She felt sick. She had a headache. Her digestion wasn't right. No, Candido, no. Well, maybe it was true. But if he ever found that son of a bitch with the raw eyes and that stupid pinche baseball cap. And he looked for them, too, everywhere. Every time Al's truck took a turn and there was somebody there beside the road, a pair of shoulders, a cap, blue jeans, and a stranger's face. Candido knew what he would do when he found him, his fist pounding on the window till the truck stopped, the vago loping up to the truck for a ride, his lucky day, and the first thing Candido could lay his hands on, the big sledge for driving stakes, the machete for clearing brush. And if he went to prison for 100 years, it would be sweet compared to this. If she was lying to him, it was to spare him, he knew that, and his heart turned over for her in his drunkenness. 17 years old, and she was the one who'd found work when he couldn't. She was the one who'd had them sniffing after her like dogs. She was the one whose husband made her live in a hut of sticks and then called her a liar, a whore, and worse. But as he lay there, watching the sparks climb into the sky, the wine infesting his veins, he knew how it was going to be, how it had to be. Knew he would follow her into that hut and slap his own pain out of her. And that was so sick and so bad. He wanted nothing more in that moment than to die. But then, dead men didn't work either, did they? 3. Smoke rose from the barbecue in fragrant ginger-smelling tufts as Delaney basted the tofu kebabs with his special honey-ginger marinade, and Jordan chased a ball round the yard with Osbert yapping at his heels. Kyra was stretched out by the pool, having finished up her jog with 40 laps of the crawl and her weekly glass of Chardonnay, and though her briefcase stood at her side, she seemed for the moment to be content with contemplating the underside of her eyelids. It was a Sunday in mid-August, 7 in the evening, the sun fixed in the sky like a Japanese lantern. There was music playing somewhere, a slow, moody piano piece moving from one lingering, faintly heard note to the next. And when Delaney looked up from turning the kebabs, he watched a California gnatcatcher, that rare and magical gray-bodied little bird, settle on the topmost wire of the fence. It was one of those special moments when all the mad, chittering whirl of things suddenly quits like a freeze frame in a film, and Delaney held on to it, savored it, even as the fragrance of ginger faded into the air, the piano faltered and the birds shot away into nothingness. Things had been tough there for a while, what with the accident, the loss of Sacheverell, the theft of the car. But now life had settled back into an easy, even keel, a mundanity that allowed the little things to reveal themselves, and he was grateful for it. "Is it ready yet?" Kyra called in a smoky, languorous voice. "Do you want me to put the dressing on the salad?" "Yeah, sure, that would be great," he said. And he felt blissful, rapturous even, as he watched his wife swing her legs over the side of the chair, adjust the straps of her swimsuit, and stride gracefully across the patio and into the rear of the house. At dinner, which Delaney served on the glass-topped table by the pool, Kyra filled her glass with Perrier and announced with a self-deprecating giggle that she'd cleaned up Shoop. Jordan was toying with his tofu, separating it from the mushrooms from the tomatoes, and the tomatoes from the onions. Osbert was under the table, gnawing at a rawhide bone. "What?" Delaney said. "What do you mean?" Kyra looked down at her plate as if uncertain how to go on. "Remember I told you about all those people gathering there on the street corners? Day laborers?" "Mexicans," Delaney said. And there was no hesitation anymore, no reluctance to identify people by their ethnicity, no overlay of liberal humanist guilt. "Mexicans. There were Mexicans everywhere." "Mexicans," Kyra confirmed with a nod. Beside her, Jordan stuffed a fork full of white rice in his mouth, chewed thoughtfully a moment, and extruded a glistening white paste back onto the tines of his fork. "I don't know," Kyra went on. "It was a couple of weeks ago, remember? By the 7-Eleven there?" Delaney nodded, dimly remembering. "Well, I got on Mike's case about it, because when it gets to be a certain number, 10 maybe, 10 is okay, but any more than that, and you can see the buyers flinch when you drive by. That's the sort of thing they're moving out here to get away from. And you know me, I'll go out of my way the most circuitous route to give people a good impression of the neighborhood, but sometimes you just have to take the boulevard. It's unavoidable. Anyway, I don't know what happened, but one day I suddenly realized there's like 50 or 60 of them out there, all stretched up and down the block, sitting on the sidewalk, leaning up against the walls. So I said to Mike, 'We got to do something.' And he got on the phone to Sid Wasserman, and I don't know what Wasserman did, but that street corner is deserted now. I mean deserted." Delaney didn't know what to say. He was wrestling with his feelings, trying to reconcile the theoretical and the actual. Those people had every right to gather on that street corner. It was their inalienable right, guaranteed by the Constitution. But whose Constitution? Mexico's? Did Mexico even have a Constitution? But that was cynical, too, and he corrected himself. He was assuming they were illegals. But even illegals had rights under the Constitution. And what if they were legal? Citizens of the USA. What then? "I mean," Kyra was saying, lifting a morsel of tofu and oyster mushroom to her lips, "I'm not proud of it or anything. And I know how you feel, and I agree that everybody's got a right to work and have a decent standard of living, but there's just so many of them. They've overwhelmed us, the schools, welfare, the prisons, and now the streets." She chewed thoughtfully, took a sip of water. "Oh, by the way, did I tell you Cynthia Sinclair got engaged? At the office?" She laughed, a little trill, and set her fork down. "I don't know what made me think of it. Prisons?" She laughed again, and Delaney couldn't help joining in. "Sure, prisons, that was it." And then she began to fill him in on Cynthia Sinclair and her fiancé and all the small details of her education, work habits, and aspirations, but Delaney wasn't listening. What she'd said about cleaning up the street corner had struck a chord, and it brought him back to the meeting he'd attended with Jack 2 nights ago. Or it wasn't a meeting, actually, but a social gathering. A few guys getting together for a drink, as Jack put it. Jack had come in the door just after 7 in a pair of shorts, white and perfectly pressed, of course, and an Izod shirt, and he and Delaney walked down the block and up 2 streets to Via Mariposa in the golden glow of the evening. Jack hadn't told them where they were going, just over to a neighbor's house, a friend, a guy I've been wanting you to meet. And as they strolled past the familiar sprawling Spanish-style homes, the walk took on the aspect of an adventure for Delaney. He and Jack were talking about everything under the sun, the Dodgers, lawn care, the situation in South Africa, the great horned owl that had taken a kitten off the Corbison's roof. And yet Delaney couldn't help wondering what the whole thing was about. What friend? What neighbor? While he barely knew half the people in the community, he was fairly confident he knew everybody in Jack's circle, the ones in Arroyo Blanco, anyway. But then they came to a house at the very end of Villa Mariposa, where the road gave out and the hills rose in a wedge above the roofline, and Delaney realized he had no idea who lived here. He'd been by the place 100 times, walking the dog, taking the air, and had never really paid much attention to it one way or the other. It was just a house. Same model as his own place, only the garage was reversed, and instead of Rancho White with Navajo trim, the owner had reversed the colors too, going with the lighter shade for the trim and the darker for the stucco. The landscaping was unremarkable, no different from any of the other places on the block. 2 tongues of lawn on either side of a crushed stone path, shrubs that weren't as drought-tolerant as they should be, a flagpole draped with a limp flag and a single fat starling perched atop it like a clot of something wiped on a sleeve. "Whose place is this?" he asked Jack as they came up the walk. "Dominic Flood's." Delaney shot him a glance. "Don't think I know him." "You should," Jack said over his shoulder, and that was all. A maid showed them in. She was small, neat, with an untraceable accent and a tight black uniform with white trim and a little white apron Delaney found excessive. Who would dress a servant up like somebody's idea of a servant, like something out of a movie? What was the point? They followed her down a corridor of genuine hand-troweled plaster, spare and bright, past a pair of rooms furnished in a southwestern motif. Navajo blankets on the walls, heavy bleached pine furniture, big clay pots of cactus and succulents, floors of unglazed tile. At the rear of the house, in the room Delaney used for his study, was a den with a wet bar, and 8 men were gathered round it, drinks in hand. They were noisy, and grew noisier when Jack stepped into the room, turning to him as one with shouts of greeting. Delaney recognized Jack Cherrystone and the bearded fat man from the meeting, Jim Shirley, and 2 or 3 others, though he couldn't place their names. "Jack!" a voice cried out behind them, and Delaney turned to see the man he presumed to be their host coming up the hallway. Flood looked to be about 60, tanned and hard as a walnut, with close-set eyes and a tight artificial weave of white hair swept back from his brow. He was barefooted, in a pair of shorts and an oversized Hawaiian print shirt, and it was impossible not to notice the device on his ankle. It was a black plastic box, 2 inches square, and it clung tight to the flesh like some sort of high-tech parasite. A thick, elastic strap held it in place. "Dom!" Jack sang, shaking the older man's hand, and then he turned to introduce Delaney. "The naturalist," Flood said without irony, and fixed him with a narrow look. "Jack's told me all about you, and of course I follow your column in Wide Open Spaces. Terrific stuff, terrific!" Delaney made a noise of demurral. "I didn't think anybody really paid that much attention. I subscribe to them all," Flood said. "Nature, High Sierra, the Thule Times, even some of the more radical newsletters. To me, there's nothing more important than the environment. Hey, where would we be without it? Floating in space?" Delaney laughed. "Besides, I have a lot of time on my hands." At this, they both glanced down at the box on his ankle, and Delaney had his first intimation of just what its function might be. "And reading sustains me on all issues. But come on in and have a drink," he was saying, already in motion, and a moment later they were standing at the bar with the others while a man in a blue satin jacket and bow tie fixed their drinks. Scotch, no ice for Jack, and a glass of Sauvignon Blanc for Delaney. It was a convivial evening, a social gathering and nothing more, at least for the first hour. And Delaney had begun to enjoy himself, set at ease immediately by his host's praise and the easy familiarity of the others. They were his neighbors, after all. When the smaller conversations began to be subsumed in a larger one, and the theme of the evening gradually began to reveal itself. Jim Shirley, sweating and huge in a Disneyland T-shirt, was leaning forward on the sofa with a drink in his hand, addressing Bill Vogel and Charlie Tillerman, the 2 men Delaney had recognized on entering, and the room fell silent to pick up his words. "Go unlisted. That's what I say. And I'm going to raise the issue at the next community meeting just to warn everybody."
"I don't think I'm following you, Jim," Jack Cherrystone rumbled from the bar, the seismic blast of his everyday voice setting the glass ashtrays in motion on the coffee table. "What do you mean, go unlisted? What difference would that make?"
Jim Shirley was a querulous fat man, bringer of bad tidings, a paranoiac, and Delaney didn't like him. But the moment belonged to Jim Shirley, and he seized it. "I'm talking about the latest rash of burglaries,
The three houses on Esperanza that got hit 2 weeks back? Well, the gate helps, no doubt about it. But these characters came in a pickup truck, ratty old clothes, a couple rakes and a mower in back, and said they were doing the Levine's place, 37 via Esperanza. The guard waves them through. But the thing is, they got the address out of the phone book, called the Levines to make sure they were out, and hit the place. And while they were at it, they got the Farrells and the Cochrans, too. So my advice is, go unlisted, and I mean everybody in the development.
It had gotten dark, and Delaney looked through his reflection to the shadowy lawn out back, half expecting to see criminals disguised as gardeners tiptoeing past with rolled-up Karastan rugs and CD players. Was nobody safe? Anywhere? Ever?
"I like the advice, Jim," Jack Jardine said. He was sitting at the bar still, nursing his second scotch. A single thick strand of hair had fallen across his forehead, giving him the look of an earnest high school debater.
"And I think you should bring it up at the next meeting, but what we should really be looking at is the larger issue of how these people are getting into our community to begin with, and the fact that the gate is just a stopgap. Hell, anybody can just park out on the canyon road and walk in from the south, or take any one of half a dozen off-the-road tracks and be out back of the development in 5 minutes. We're all vulnerable to that. And what Jim didn't tell you, or hasn't told you yet, is what happened to Sonny Demandia."
There was a portentousness to Jack's tone that put Delaney off. He was manipulating the room the way he manipulated a courtroom, and Delaney resented him for it. Was this what Jack had brought him for? To get him on his team? Jim Shirley, who seemed to be the official trader in horror stories, was about to lay bare the Sonny Demandia episode in all its lurid detail when Delaney heard his own voice plunging into the gap.
"So what do you mean, Jack? Isn't the gate enough? Next thing you're going to want to wall the whole place in, like a medieval city or something."
Delaney had expected laughter, a murmur or two of assent, anything to confirm the absurdity of the proposition. But he was met by silence. Everyone was watching him. He felt uneasy suddenly, all the spirit of camaraderie dissolved in that instant. Wall the place in. That was exactly what they intended to do. That was what they were here for. That was the purpose of the gathering. "We're all praying for Sonny," Jim Shirley said then. "And the latest prognosis is for a full and speedy recovery. But the man, or men, the police aren't sure yet, who got in there last week did a lot of damage. And I don't mean just physical damage, because I don't know if a woman ever really recovers from something like that." He paused to heave a deep alveolar sigh. A hand went to his face, moist and doughy, and he pressed his drink to his brow like a wet cloth. "You all know Sonny, don't you?" he said finally, lifting his head to survey the room. "Fabulous woman, one of the best. 62 years old and as active in this community as anybody." Another sigh. A rigid compression of the jowls. "She left the back door open. That was her mistake. Thinking it was safe up here. What an irony, huh?" "It was our first violent crime," Jack put in. "The first, and let's make damn sure it's the last." "Amen," Jim Shirley said. And then he went into the grisly details, step by step, moment by moment, sparing them nothing. Delaney filtered him out. He was watching his host, who was curled up now in the corner of a pastel couch, his bare legs propped on the coffee table, idly scratching his calf. As they'd sat together earlier at the bar, Jack had given him an abbreviated explanation of the device on Flood's ankle. He was a client of Jack's, a good guy, ambitious, and his bank, there had been 3 local branches, and he personally oversaw them all, had got entangled in some unwise investments, as Jack put it. The device was on loan from the Los Angeles County Electronic Monitoring Service house arrest program, and he would be wearing it, night and day, for the next 3 years. Delaney had been stunned. 3 years, he'd whispered, glancing in awe at the black plastic manacle on Flood's ankle. "You mean he can't leave this house for 3 years?" Jack had nodded curtly. "Better than prison, wouldn't you say?" Now, as Jim Shirley droned on, practically slobbering over the nasty little details of the assault on Sonny Demandia, who'd begun to take on a mythical dimension since Delaney didn't know her from Queen Ida or Hillary Clinton, Delaney couldn't help studying Dominic Flood out of the corner of his eye. 3 years without a walk in the woods, dinner out, even a stroll down the supermarket aisles. It was unthinkable. And yet there it was. If he left the 150-foot radius they'd given him, a buzzer would go off and the police would come and lock him away in a place with a lot fewer amenities than this one. No wonder he liked to read about the great outdoors. He wasn't going to see anything beyond the backyard fence for a long time to come. The conversation had focused for a while on Sonny Demandia. Expressions of concern, outrage, fear, and loathing. And now the maid reappeared with coffee and a tray of cakes and brioches. The distraction was welcome, and as the 11 men settled down to the quotidian tasks of stirring the hot liquid, measuring out sugar and sweet and low, plying knife and fork, chewing, swallowing, belching softly to themselves, a peace fell over the room, dispelling the news of rapes and break-ins and the general decline and disintegration of the world around them. Someone mentioned baseball, and the conversation chased off after the subject with a sense of genuine relief. From the hills behind the house came the distant, breathless, barking yelp of a coyote, answered almost immediately by another, somewhere off to the north. "The natives are getting restless," Jack Cherrystone rumbled, and everyone laughed. "You think they want to come in and join us?" Bill Vogel said. He was a tall, wraith-like man, bowed under the weight of a sickle nose. "They probably get a little tired of raw rat or whatever they're eating out there. If I was a coyote, I'll bet this piece of cheesecake would really hit the spot." Jack Cherrystone, diminutive, his head too big for his frame, his eyes too big for his head, turned to Delaney.
"I don't think Delaney would approve, Bill," he said, his voice carving canyons beneath their feet. "Would you, Delaney?"
Delaney reddened. How many of these men had been present at the meeting the night he'd made such an ass of himself? "No," he said, and he tried to smile. "No, I'm afraid I wouldn't."
"What about that labor exchange business, Dom?" Jack Jardine said out of nowhere, and the grinning faces turned from Delaney to him, and then to their host.
Flood was standing now, dipping his chin delicately to take a sip of coffee from the cup he held over the saucer in his hand. He gave Jack a wink, moved across the floor to lay an arm over his shoulder and address the room in general. "That little matter's been taken care of, and it was no big deal, believe me, just a matter of a few phone calls to the right people. Joe Nardoni of the Topanga Homeowners Association told me the people down there were good and sick of the whole business anyway. It was an experiment that didn't work."
"Good."
Jack Cherrystone was perched on a bar stool, his legs barely reaching the bottom rung.
"I mean, I'm as sympathetic as the next guy, and I feel bad about it. And I can see where the Topanga property owners really wanted to do something for these people, but the whole thing was wrong-headed from the start."
"I'll say," Bill Vogel put in with real vehemence, "the more you give them, the more they want, and the more of them there are." But the professional boom of Jack Cherrystone's voice absorbed and flattened his words, and Jack went on without missing a beat.
"Why should we be providing jobs for these people when we're looking at a 10% unemployment rate right here in California, and that's for citizens? Furthermore, I'm willing to bet you'll see a big reduction in the crime rate once the thing's closed down. And if that isn't enough of a reason, I'm sorry, but quite frankly, I resent having to wade through them all every time I go to the post office. No offense, but it's beginning to look like fucking Guadalajara or something down there."
Dominic Flood was beaming. He was the host, the man of the house, the man of the hour. He shrugged his shoulders in deprecation. What he'd done was nothing, the least thing, a little favor, that was all, and they should all rest easy. "By this time next week," he announced, "the labor exchange is history." Delaney was thinking about that as Kyra came to the end of her dissertation on Cynthia Sinclair. Kyra had cleaned up the corner of Shoop and Ventura, and Dominic Flood had cleaned up the labor exchange. All right. But where were these people supposed to go? Back to Mexico? Delaney doubted it, knowing what he did about migratory animal species and how one population responded to being displaced by another. It made for war, for violence and killing, until one group had decimated the other and reestablished its claims to the prime hunting, breeding, or grazing grounds. It was a sad fact, but true. He tried to shrug it off. The evening was perfect, his life on track again, his hikes as stimulating as ever, and his powers of observation and description growing sharper as he relaxed into the environment. Why dwell on the negative, the paranoiac, the wall-builders and excluders? He was part of it now. Complicit by his very presence here, and he might as well enjoy it. Looking up from his food,